he could not realize and did not, that a great part of his subjective existence was merely objectivity moving in upon him. Thus his visions, his meditations, his reflections could well be only the symbolic representations of his activities. But not certain of this, not having any yardstick with which to measure, he fell into the habit of assuming that these internal patterns were not merely projections of environment, but represented some kind of a life within him. At least he had an interpretive internal by which he could give new meaning and color to even the most common of everyday experiences. Thus, inwardly, he developed imagination. And imagination, in turn, became one of the most powerful creative forces that he had. And yet this same imagination could be a danger. For if he could imagine progress, he could also imagine trouble. He could find himself creating false values and imposing them upon his environment. This is particularly true of intense introversion because it nearly always results in a false estimation of externals. It causes the individual not only to escape from realities, but to seek to escape from his own interpretation of realities, thus burying himself deeper and deeper into the subjective part of his own life. The only possible censorship by which man could determine whether his internal life was valid or not was through experimentation. And the only experiment that was really useful was to determine, if possible, what would happen internally if external pressures were removed. This led, of course, to the life of renunciation. It led to the individual's conscious and voluntary detachment from externals, his rejection of them, in an effort to determine how his own life would be if it was not constantly conditioned by objective activity. Thus came the gradual religious belief that if man is to have an inner life, he must in some way relax his outer life, that he cannot serve two masters, and that if he is to follow the prince of this world, he cannot know the mystery of the other world. Obviously, the changing patterns of his objective life did affect his subjective reactions and reflexes. He found that if he refined his personal living, if he rejected or renounced extremes, if he sought to live moderately, if he did not permit himself to be possessed by his own possessions, or obsessed by the attitudes of those around him, that gradually his internal life became more tranquil. To the degree, therefore, that he did not waste energy, he had more energy available for other things. All these circumstances undoubtedly affected his dream life in sleep. And where he was not under false external pressures, he did not have the unpleasant dreams that still are unfortunate emblems of neurosis. He also discovered through time, however, that the dreams did not follow his inclinations, but followed his attainments only. Therefore, if he renounced intellectually certain beliefs or attitudes, but still cherished them in himself, the dreams remained true to the facts and not to the policies which he was attempting to adapt. It therefore became a kind of censorship. Things had to be true, they had to be real, they had to be right. Renunciation of material objectives had to be honest, or else the internal life did not change or was not refined. he observed that sanctified persons, those who had truly achieved a spiritual life, had experiences in dreams and sleep appropriate to their attainments. Their sleep became beautiful. Their inner life became rich. And whether it was because, again, it was reflecting the attainments of their outer personalities was not of the first concern. It was, this change was real. And moreover, this change was of great comfort and great utility and became the basis of an inspiration for common service by which the teacher, the leader, the priest came into natural and reasonable existence. So through all these procedures, Western man gradually integrated a large psychological concept. He became aware that man must have action and rest. He came to realize also that internals and externals must be balanced, and that the individual whose internal life was neglected would ultimately fail in his external concerns. He also realized the increasing danger of this crisis due to the rapid development of externals and also due to the natural channel of the sensory perceptions which were responsive particularly to externals and therefore were bombarding his inner life constantly with reflexes and sensory reactions. Out of this came the philosophic life, or the life of reason, the life of rationality, the individual organizing his affairs, seeking to bring a pattern suitable to his needs upon all of his activities. Muhammad, prophet of Islam, is said to have established a code by which he divided the day into three equal parts, each consisting of 8 hours. One of these parts he devoted to the needs of his people, the second to the private needs of his own life, and the third to rest. By following this regime carefully, he found that in all departments he was more able, had greater resources, and he discovered what many have discovered, namely that internal integration reduces the time factor in accomplishment. The person moving from a strong inner point can achieve more in an hour than the unorganized individual can achieve in a day. Therefore, time taken for integration is not time lost. The integrated result becomes a great time-energy conservation, and work is man's expenditure of energy within time. And therefore, it is important that he recognize that he is a creature with limited energy available, that he must use these to the best of his ability, and at the same time protect adequately his own recuperative power. By the organization of living, he therefore balanced his relationship with nature. He paid his proper taxes to the universe, and learn not to overtax himself. This all led to our recognition of another point, namely that civilizations, cultures, systems can become so complicated and so heavy that they gradually press in upon the individual and destroy him. Man must then learn to discriminate between the importance of the things he does and the value of the thing he is. This discrimination is not yet generally attained, but it is a discrimination that must come, for without it, man cannot survive. Now, all this development in Western thinking was polarized by another development, which is essentially the Eastern approach to the mystery of sleep, and to the symbolism which it implies. In the Orient, the question has naturally arisen as to why the human being is in a state of constant turmoil. In other words, the East questions empirically and totally what we call our way of life. Instead of achieving a compromise with nature, as has been the tendency of Western man, instead of attempting a personal adjustment with action and repose, the Eastern individual comes straight to what he considers to be the basic problem, namely, what is the purpose of man? Now, in the West, we will have 100 answers, most of them essentially identical. The same is true in the East. We will have many systems, many sects, many groups, many beliefs, but to a large measure, they will unite in one purpose, in one concept. Namely, the essential purpose for man, or of man, is the unfoldment of his internal life by intent. The purpose of man is not to build a greater world, primarily, but to build a greater internal integration. In the East, therefore, we have this concept that man should first find himself in order that he may know his needs, that he may understand them, and that he may plan for them, and that the beginning of progress is the overcoming of ignorance, and that the ignorant individual can leave a monument, but it will be in the wrong place, and it will also be the wrong monument, and others must sometime move it away. We remember, of course, years ago, there was an epidemic of creating statues in local communities, these statues frequently representing either a Civil War soldier or a Spanish-American War veteran. These stood in every town, often flanked with a cannon and a heap of cannonballs. In the course of time, it has been necessary to move practically every one of these statues because they always stood where some improvement was absolutely necessary. In the course of time, therefore, things which sentimentally were well-intended had to be shifted, changed, and readapted to meet the rise, for example, of an automotive generation among peoples. And the living must ultimately take precedence over the traditions of the dead. That which is necessary must be done. In this thinking, the East, then, had a tendency, a very strong tendency, to reverse the entire sleep-waking concept. Instead of assuming, therefore, that by sleep was meant a kind of inaction, they took the attitude that sleep was in one way or another the strange symbol of total action. That sleep, perhaps, was the one state of man which was true. Because in his waking, he has become totally submerged in his own psychological mechanisms. The moment he wakes up, he makes a mistake. This, in turn, requires five more to make it endurable. These, in turn, require more mistakes to sustain them. And before he is finished, these mistakes cause him so much economic expense that he is hardly able to support himself. In order to meet this emergency, he must work harder, which means that he must eat more, which means that he must sleep longer, and he enters into a vicious circle in which he works in order to pay for sleep, and sleeps in order to have energy to work. This confusion does not appear solutional to Eastern man. Perhaps one of the reasons is that his total nature is different, that he never moved, or has not as yet moved, from the tremendous religious foundation of the past onto the highly industrialized foundation of today. Even if he makes this move, he will probably be a rather different person from Western man, because as the child, differently conditioned, shows this conditioning in maturity, we know that whereas the West began to move strongly onto a materialistic footing at a very early time. The East has remained through its childhood, infancy, and adolescence largely upon a theological footing. And even if it should change over now, the vast experience behind it will not easily be totally obliterated. Eastern man, then, comes to this conclusion. What are the things about living that we do not like? Well, we do not like worry, fear, grief. We are constantly bombarded with stimuli which cause us to release negative foreboding. We are surrounded constantly by evidence, which if once we become melancholy ourselves, bears witness to tragedy. We see around us either life or death, according to our own natures. One man will say, there is a person born every second. Another will say, there is a man die every second. It depends upon our attitude. And the bombardment of the pressures which we now are forced to endure have gradually corroded and corrupted our optimism until we look out upon a world ever more frightening in its aspect, ever more likely to cause disturbance to our own inner life. Disturbed in ourselves, we disturb each other, and the personal securities of home, family, and friendship are undermined, until by degrees we return to a kind of concrete jungle, filled with advantages and inventions and ingenuities, but incapable of preventing man's inhumanity to man. Now, Buddha, in one of his discourses, asked a disciple whether or not he would consider it wonderful if man could come to a condition in which he neither worried nor feared, in which he was not obsessed, in which he was not variously made miserable by ambitions or by various circumstances around him. If he could therefore attain this state in which fear no longer existed, in which pain, moral pain, emotional pain, were no longer real, in which there was no uncertainty about providence, in which the individual was not burdened by suffering in any of its attributes. Would not such a situation be miraculous? The disciple assented, and Buddha pointed out that this occurs to man every time he goes to sleep. For when he is asleep, he is not afraid. When he is asleep, he is not suffering from emotional or mental pain. When he is asleep, he is not overambitious. When he is asleep, he is not aware of tragedy or darkness. He is aware, apparently, of nothing. So Buddha pointed out this point, or this fact, that sleep, in some way, wraps up all this tangle of life and gives it a blessed rest. And that in this unconsciousness alone, man is released from consciousness. Now, this would seem to be a rather doubtful way of attaining release. Western man would rather climb the mountain, fight his way inch by inch by sheer aggression, in the hope that ultimately he can fashion a golden age out of his own skill and attainment. The East, however, points out very obviously and very sensibly that if without sleep, man would die under the present tensions and stress of living. And therefore, his life is rooted, his survival is rooted in unconsciousness, not in consciousness. It is not his consciousness, but his unconsciousness that preserves him, makes it possible for him to continue, and gives him that blessed respite from all these things which he calls important. Yet Buddha also was enough of a psychologist to realize there was a difference between sleep and death. And the analysis of this difference was not in a degree of man's awareness, but in the facts themselves. The sleeping man is not dead. He is alive. Therefore, unconsciousness is not death, as we have come to believe it to be. Unconsciousness is not not being. For the tired, tense, struggling man, finding sleep, relaxes, the lines depart from his face. He attains a strangely wonderful and peaceful appearance. He becomes the very personification of contentment while he is asleep. The moment he awakens, his brow wrinkles. He begins to remember the things he should have done or should be doing. Haste takes over, and he is picked up into this strange confusion of living. So in sleep, man suddenly becomes not a child exactly, but he becomes a totally integrated being. If he can do no good, he can do no harm. If he is not doing something, he at least is in the blessed state of not doing anything that is detrimental to him. And that is more than most persons can accomplish in a waking state. He may not be wise, but he is not intemperate. He may not be contributing to his income, but he is certainly not squandering his means. So it is a kind of strange situation that has a great many interesting and intriguing thoughts associated with it. A man going to sleep becomes unconscious of himself. He no longer knows where he is, what he is, or who he is. This in itself is a blessed revelation. He therefore has no false estimations about himself. He is no longer a little man trying to be great, or a great man trying to find happiness. And yet, this man who goes to sleep enters this state with a solemn trust. He expects inevitably to awaken. And should he not awaken, he is not even prepared, mentally or emotionally, to contemplate the idea. He simply believes that he goes from his objective state into a security of rest, that this is right and proper, necessary and good. And yet in the appointed hour, he will awaken. He will awaken without knowing that he is going to awaken. He will awaken without any conscious effort to rouse himself. He will simply emerge from this state of subjectivity. And gradually, his center of awareness will move into the machinery of his sensory perceptions, and he will again be an objective creature. Thus, this thing which we call unconsciousness has in some mysterious way the power within itself to restore consciousness, to release it again. And from that which knows not itself, that which knows itself is restored to its own existence. Furthermore, when man goes to sleep, the past is not wiped out. He is not aware of it. It does not exist while he is asleep. But when he awakens, memory is restored and he remembers the unbroken continuity of the previous day, but he does not remember the period of sleep. Many very wise and worthwhile observations can be based upon this. Buddha therefore recommended the concept that in sleep, man moves from a fragmentary state into a total state. That therefore he is never more completely alive than when he is asleep. Not because he is aware, but because there is no division of his faculties or his members or his parts. He is not dead. He is not in oblivion. He is simply in a strange state which he cannot examine with his objective faculties. The mind and the senses cannot analyze sleep because it belongs to a condition which they cannot experience due to the fact that they are totally objective. Man can contemplate the mystery of sleep. He can observe it in others. He can interpret it. But man cannot rationally experience it, because the moment it sets in, he cannot experience. And the only experiences he can have relating to it are the driftings in and out, or the disturbances caused by a dream phenomena during sleep. But total and complete sleep itself is a descending of oblivion. And yet in this oblivion, nothing ends. In this oblivion, there is no factor which divides, which abruptly terminates anything. Therefore, all consciousness, as we know it, moves unconsciously through sleep without any change or diminution in itself. It moves very much as the radio wave, which can be understood in its source and can be interpreted in the receiving set, but which moves invisibly and intangibly through the connecting atmosphere, where it cannot be observed and cannot be analyzed. In the sleeping state, man then is rescued by a total experience, and that is why sleep rests him. It is why sleep is the solution to all exhaustion and fatigue, because in some way, beyond our cognition, it is the restatement of the reality in ourselves. In this phenomenon, therefore, some part of consciousness with which we are not aware, with which we are not capable of objective function, which does not contain within it the complex of selfhood, which is the source of man's objective life. This consciousness, beyond self-consciousness, becomes the healer, becomes the wonderful source of the remedying of all of the defects caused by selfness. If this be true, we have the psychological basis of Buddhistic philosophy, which seeks to attain this situation or condition of not selfness, which is not the denial of self, but the suspension of the self in something superior to itself, namely consciousness itself. Now, we think of consciousness always in terms of self-consciousness. Buddha insisted that this is not correct. Self-consciousness is almost the antonym of consciousness. It is its dualistic polarity, differing from it in almost all respects, inasmuch as self-consciousness is the consciousness of things, the consciousness of one as apart from, whereas true consciousness is the experience of all or of totality. And because of totality, it cannot have a differentiated polarization. So man retiring into sleep retires into universal consciousness. He calls it sleep because it is the suspension of those faculties which he has developed and upon which he depends for what he calls his waking state. We have no reason to know, however, that what we call sleep is not in itself a superior state of consciousness to that of waking. Now, this opens a large problem, and man cannot empirically answer it because he has not faculties capable of analyzing sleep, which means that he has not the ability to experience a consciousness apart from self-awareness. Self-awareness ceases in sleep, yet life goes on. The records of life go on. And from an unawareness, self-awareness is regenerated by awaking, so that it has been there all the time. Yet man has transcended it, suspended it. And because of this, if his rest is proper and correct, he awakens refreshed. Thus, in a way, self-awareness is the source of fatigue. And the suspension of self-awareness is the perfect rest. Now, rest does not mean inaction. Rest is not merely a negative thing. Because if rest was nothing, it could refresh nothing. Nor could it contribute to the function of anything. In rest, man attains to the availability of total energy. Therefore, rest is positive, and objectivity, which is the exhaustion of energy, is negative. And man lives because of an energy moving from rest to action. And without the transcendent, undivided, total energy behind him, he could not sustain any particular activity. Buddha went then so far as to explain, in his comprehension, that what we call universal unconscious consciousness is really a total consciousness which man is totally incapable of registering. Therefore, the departure into sleep, resulting in the suspension of faculties, causes man to lose self-awareness. But in so doing, he is restored to universal fact or universal awareness. He cannot know the universal, but in sleep, the universal knows him. And by uniting itself with him, restores his ability to continue his objective life. From these and many other considerations, you can see how interesting a field of speculation can be opened by sleep. How it can contribute and has to the foundation of religions and philosophies, and how some comprehension of it, or at least certain of its consequences, could assist the individual by giving him incentives toward the regulation of his own conduct, so that he is capable of greater repose, greater rest, and greater faith in a universal life moving through him into action. From these things, modern man can take some comfort in the sincere belief that to the degree that he understands and cooperates with the great cycles of action and inaction in nature, he gains a security through the moderation of his own excesses and becomes capable, therefore, of a pleasant waking state and a dreamless sleep, or one in which there are no phantoms to distract him. That the dream only represents the encroachment of his objective state upon his experience of total consciousness. If he is immersed too deeply in materialism, he cannot even escape it in sleep. But he should escape it, and he must escape it, through the reorganization of his career and his conduct. Because without this daily re-identification with life itself, he cannot endure. Nor can he have the resources to advance any proper program of growth and unfoldment. Time's up. Now, I have two or three announcements which I'd like to make. I'm speaking on Wednesday evening, the Women's University Club, 6th and Catalina, at 8 o'clock, in connection with the conference of the Association for Research and Enlightenment, the work carrying on the activities of Edgar Cayce. Anyone, I believe, who is interested is invited to attend. I would like to mention the fact that I placed a note on our bulletin board this morning relating to the distribution of literature on our premises by persons not authorized to do so. I understand literature, which was highly, shall we say, colored, was offered to our people within the body of this theater last Sunday morning. This is without our consent and is an infraction of the proper rules of domicile, inasmuch as during a rental of this theater, it is our property. And therefore, any such action is unauthorized and improper. We cannot, however, prevent legally the distribution of literature on public sidewalks or outside the boundaries of our own rental area. We do, however, wish to point out that any literature other than that which relates to our own activities is not authorized nor endorsed by us. And we hope that we will not have a recurrence of this situation. I would also like to call attention to the fact that on the 26th of this month, I fly to New York for a series of lectures, which will continue for about 3.5 weeks. During that time, I will also make short trips of one lecture each to Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I would suggest that if you have friends in those areas, that you ask them to watch their local papers. Our general announcements for books this morning will cover, perhaps, various writings that we have dealing with consciousness. Our principal text on that subject is our book, Lectures on Ancient Philosophy, which we have not announced here for some time. We suggest that you consider it. And also for current lecture activities and notes and the republication of our various articles, we recommend that you subscribe to our magazine, Horizon. Also, we have several lecture booklets on the table now of lectures given here recently, some of which you may have missed and which you would like to have. Those interested in a further analysis of the discussion of the morning are invited to attend the headquarters study group, which meets at our headquarters at Griffith Park and Los Feliz Boulevards at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Those attending will be guests of the headquarters study group, and you are invited to come and bring your friends. The subject will be a further consideration of the work of this morning. I'd like to also mention at this time that our last subject on this program and our last lecture here until April will be next Sunday morning, The Soul Image as the Immortal Friend. This is an interesting psychological problem, and the basis of a great deal of drama, literature, poetry, philosophy, religious ritual, and symbolism. The story of the soul as the immortal and eternal friend of man. This Promethean friend is well worthy of careful thought. So we hope you will all be with us for the closing lecture next Sunday morning, and that you will bring your friends. And if you wish announcements of our future activities and the continuation of our lectures and seminars, and are not on our mailing list, will you please leave your names and addresses? Our mailing lists are not sold or exchanged. Therefore, you will not receive any publicity or announcements other than our own. Thank you very kindly for being with us this morning.